Hello again, this is Jim Veltz doing the lectionary at lunch for Mark chapter 8, verses 27 to 38. Another blockbuster set of verses with all kinds of theology and grammar and considerations. So we're going to take two trips through the text. The first one on the basic grammar, and then we'll talk a little theology. Let me introduce this first of all by saying that this begins the fourth section of the Gospel of Mark. The first section goes from 1 to 8, and then the second section goes until 1-9, until the end of chapter 7, 7:37. Then the third section is 8:1 to 8:26, ending with the man where he receives his sight in two stages. And that seems to be also a little bit, what shall we say, allegorical, in that it implies that there will be a second sight that's obtained. So now we go to the fourth part, 8:27 to 10:52, and the fifth part will be the betrayal, suffering, and death of Jesus in chapter 11, 1 to 16:8. But we're in section 4, and these two chapters, really, from 8:27 through 10:52, are the most central and the most critical of the whole of the Gospel of Mark. So here you get, on the one hand, a move to a new section, but with a linkage back to the previous passage, which was 8:22 to 26, the healing of the blind man in two stages. With that, you get an intercalation or an ABA pattern with the final pericope of this section, 10:46 to 52. That's blind Bartimaeus, blind Bartimaeus. So you have discussions of blindness on the outside with instructions on the inside. You might say the interior chapters are flanked by these discussions of blindness interiorly, 8:31, 9:31, 10:33, and 34 are the three passion predictions. So we already know there's something afoot here with sight being achieved and the passion predictions. So the this section opens then with 8:27 to 30, which concerns Jesus's identity. And, you know, it seems as if from the previous pericope, we're going to get a second stage of sight now, especially on the part of Peter and the 12. Peter has a right view. You are the Christ. But we'll see that this is a little more complex than it looks. Now, it's key that in this entire section, that is to say, from 8:27 to 10:52, Jesus turns his focus to his disciples and instructs them rather than focusing upon the crowds and using a lot of public teaching or doing a lot of healing. Now, there's only one example of public teaching in 9:13a, and the healings, 9:14 to 27, the boy with the demon, and 10:46 to 52, blind Bartimaeus. Now, even the confrontation with the negative authorities, the Jewish leaders, is kept to a minimum, and that really only occurs in 10:2 to 9. So all of the developments, the way Mark has set this up, serve this instructional purpose. And Jesus is on his way now to Jerusalem to meet his destiny. Now, in this section, two key sub-themes come to the fore: the necessity of Jesus' suffering and dying before triumph, and the necessity of the disciples themselves following after Jesus on his path. And now the noun hadas, path, way, becomes prominent and occurs some seven times in this section, including right in the first verse of the section, that when they were on the hado, he began to ask them something, and it also occurs in the last verse of the section, 10:52. So as Jesus is on his path to Jerusalem to meet his destiny, where he'll give his life as a ransom for many, and people follow him, some willingly, some not so willingly, on this appointed way. This Hadash theme, this way theme, recalls the early verses of Mark's gospel, where Jesus's way, Hadash, is to be prepared by John the Baptist in 1:2-3, in fulfillment of the Exodus passages and the fulfillment of the passages in Malachi and Isaiah. So this actually reflects a kind of an important Isaianic connection, which pictures the coming of Yahweh to Zion, leading his blind people, note, blind people on the way. So, for example, 42:16, and he is leading his people to Jerusalem, Zion in Isaiah 51, verse 11. So let's move in from there after that little introduction. I can't really overemphasize how important these middle chapters are in the Gospel of Mark. You know, everybody talks about Mark being a passion narrative with an introduction. That's not really the case. This is really all about having a vision about Jesus and who he is and what he's about. So we'll start in on 8:27. And Jesus went out and his disciples. Notice that "and his disciples" is kind of an add-on there, into the villages of Caesarea Philippi, Caesarea of Philip, and in the way, on the way or the road, he began to ask his disciples, saying to them, "Who do men say that I am?" Now, let's just go back there. First of all, Caesarea of Philip was not the Caesarea Maritima on the Mediterranean Sea, where the headquarters of the Roman prefect, later procurator, would be located. In other words, the Roman prefect was not in Jerusalem. He was at Caesarea on the sea. But then there was another Caesarea, which is a place that used to be called Banias or Panias, dedicated to the god Pan, which was north and east of the Sea of Galilee. And Herod Philip dedicated it to Augustus, and so it became known then as the Caesarea of Philip. Now, on the road, he began to ask his disciples, saying, literally now, "Whom do they say me to be?" If you're following in the Greek, notice tina is accusative singular, me is accusative singular, and we have an infinitive einai. So, men, legusin, say me, to be, einai, tina, whom. So, who do men, people, say that I am? That's literally, that's more smoothly what it is. Literally, who do they say me to be? Now, this is an example, actually, of the use of the infinitive in indirect discourse. Now, this is in chapter 42, I believe, of Fundamental Greek Grammar. Often the Greeks did use this, the infinitive in indirect discourse, and then the subject and the predicate with a verb to be are both in the accusative case. Subject of the infinitive, if not the same as the subject of the main verb, is going to be in the accusative case. And with the verb to be, you're going to have a predicate noun or a predicate pronoun, and that will be in the same case, which is accusative case in this case. Note, he is in a Gentile area, and all of a sudden, the Greek's getting better. He doesn't use this kind of construction when he's just roaming around Galilee. 28. Hoi de ipon auto legantes. Hoi de switches the subject. Very much more Greek kind of expression rather than simply saying kai ipon. No, this is hoide, switching the subject. Ipon, third plural, aorist indicative active. Note the weak aorist termination on the strong aorist stem, ipe. Normally that would have been ipon, omicron knee, but they started using these weak aorist terminations on there. So what did they say? We omit the hoti, or if you're going to read the hoti, it's hoti recitative, which means it's the hoti that introduces a direct quotation. Now, here's the first thing they say, Ioannein ton baptistein, John the Baptist. Now, why is that accusative? Well, because it's mimicking the construction of verse 27. Whom do they say me to be? They say me to be John the Baptist. And so that's in the accusative case. And others, Elias. Others, Aloi, Elion, which is Elijah, and others, De, and others, one of the prophets, or that you are one of the prophets. Now, the Helion is accusative because it's still continuing that infinitive construction. But then with Aloi, you get the Hutti clause and or direct discourse, and then you get nominatives. So one of the prophets. I want you to notice here, there's a little mark and trick. He's got three different statements, and they're all constructed grammatically different. The first one, simply accusatives, reflecting the previous clause. The second one has a subject alloy and an accusative. And the third one has a subject alloy and hoti plus the nominative. And this is very, very typical of Mark's Greek. Whenever there is a string of things, like three things, they will never all be identical. It will always be that there is an ABB, AAB, ABA pattern, some kind of a pattern like that. And we can see it right here. Nifty piece of writing. 29. Kai autos ep a rota autus. And he, autos, probably does not mean self here. And he said, proceeded to ask them, ep a rota. That again, just like up in verse 27, ep a rota is a, both of those are a third person singular, imperfect, indicative, active of an a-o contract verb, erotao, erotao. Fundamental Greek Grammar, chapter 30. Take a look at that. All of the contract verbs are always very difficult in the imperfect tense. And he proceeded to say to them, humais, you guys, yous, or if you're in Pittsburgh, yuns, whom me to be do you say? Who do you say me to be? Who do you say that I am? In response, Peter says to him, Si I ho Christos, you are the Christ. Okay? So the first structure is similar to the one up in 27. Now, notice that the verb switches to present tense for the verb of speaking, legai, which foregrounds this. Peter says to him, you are the anointed one, the Christ. Apokrithais, in answer, aorist passive participle, masculine singular nominative. Not having answered, he said, but by way of giving an answer, he said. Probably the same action as the main verb. We'll come back and talk about Christus in just a minute. 30. Kai ep e te ti me sen autois. And he rebuked them, sternly warned them, hina. That, notice that epitimesen is an aorist indicative active. So it brings that string of imperfect indicatives to a nice conclusion. Hina clause is not purpose. It is the object of what he admonished them, that to no one they speak concerning him. Now, notice in the hina clause, you're going to get a subjunctive, and we get legosin. But let's keep our wits about us here. The legosin is a present subjunctive, not an aorist. So we've got to have a little extra in there, a little whoop-de-doo, that they try to speak concerning him to no one, or that they actually speak to him concerning him to no one. But you can't just say that they speak to him, because legosin is a present subjunctive. It is not an aorist subjunctive. So there's a little extra that you have to put into that. 31. And by the way, again, the hina clause is the object clause. 31. And he began, erxita, and that normally takes the present infinitive. There it is, didaskein. He began to teach them that it was necessary. We're going to put that back one step for indirect discourse in a secondary sequence. It's secondary because erxita is a past tense. He began to teach them that it was necessary. What was necessary? Now you're going to get a string of infinitives, which are technically the subject of what's necessary. Okay? So you're going to get an infinitive constructions, and these infinitive constructions will then have accusatives as their subjects, generally speaking, and of course accusatives as their object. So you have ton huion tu anthropu. Notice ton huion, accusative, is the subject. It was necessary that the Son of Man, pola, adverbial, suffer a lot. You could say many things, but either that or a lot. And apo dokimasthenai, that he be rejected. Dokimadzo is to test for approval. And apo, away, you're rejecting that test for approval. That he be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes. Now notice there, that threefold group is essentially what makes up the Sanhedrin. The prominent families are the elders, the chief priests, that's the priestly class, and the scribes, who are the learned doctors of Scripture, and they're the conservative party. And ktanthenai, that he be killed, and after 3 days, meta tris himeras, anastenai, that he rise. Now, I want you to notice that form, anastenai. That's a nice example of a strong aorist, third principal part of histemi, to stand. Stenai is intransitive, that he arise. Note, that is not a sixth principal part of agairo, that he be raised up, that he be raised up if there's an indication of an agency there. But not only is there no indication of agency, this is an intransitive verb. I mean, people have got to realize how important this is. This is an affirmation that the Son of Man is going to rise on his own steam, so to speak. It's not that he will simply be raised by someone else. This use of anistemi is a very old use in the New Testament, and is probably from the oldest confessional creeds. Then it says in 32, so just to parse anastenai again, that's an aorist active infinitive. It's a strong aorist with stenai, and it is active voice. 32, kai paresia ton logon elalai, and in boldness, he was openly speaking, laleo, ton logon, not the word, the matter. Logos is never kind of the word. It's, well, I shouldn't say never. but it generally is not a word in our sense, but more a discussion, a matter, an account. So he was discussing the matter openly. Elalai, third singular, imperfect, indicative, active of laleo. And it means open declaration of things. Kai pros la bominas, ha petras, auton, erxata epitiman auto. And upon taking him to himself for his own purpose, notice the nice middle voice there, Peter began to epitimon, to scold him. Notice that's the same word in 8:30, to strongly admonish him. And that's going to be a present infinitive because archamai with erxata, archamai is going to take a present infinitive. Hode, 33. But he, now this is the other guy in the conversation, so it's Jesus, epistrophes, upon turning and seeing his disciples, admonished Peter, epetimesen, Peter. Epistrophes, tough form, not a second person singular present indicative active. This is an aorist passive participle, masculine singular nominative from epistrepho. Notice when you have the straph form of strephel, that's always the sixth principal part. It's a strong form, meaning that it does not have the key or giveaway letter in it. It doesn't have the theta. So it's not estrophthys, but just without the theta, strophthys. He, upon turning or turned and having seen his disciples, he admonished Peter and he says to him, note again the present tense, legai, go, episomu, behind me, Satan, because you are not thinking, phronice, ta tu theu, the things of God, but ta ton anthropon, the things of men. Now, what are the things of God and the things of men? Well, we're going to kind of find this out in the upcoming verses here. But we're also going to see when we take a look, as we take a second shot through here, about Jesus' depiction of himself. Now, you know what's another one of these strange Markan matters? What is this business upon seeing his disciples? You know, that's not in the other Gospels. He admonished Peter. If the other disciples hadn't been there, would he have let it go? I mean, you know, it's kind of a strange thing like that. But certainly, I think at least we can say that he had to do this because Peter was doing something wrong and giving a wrong impression. So as he was communicating with others about the kind of thing Jesus ought to do, he was basically not communicating the right thing, and Jesus has to nip that in the bud. 34. Kai pros kalesamenas, and upon summoning the crowd with his disciples, he said to them. Now, this is interesting. Notice that the verb for speaking now goes to the aorist. You almost get this impression. This is more typical of the second half of the book of Mark. But you almost get the impression that when it goes to aorist, he is kind of lowering his voice and making a blockbuster statement as opposed to kind of being more in your face about something. Like, for example, in verse 33, where he admonished Peter and says, see, and that kind of ups the ante in terms of the feel of the passage. So here's one of the few places the crowd comes into this again. I think what that does is it helps us to realize that this is not a private matter, what he's saying now, that it's, let's say, secret information for the disciples. No, it's not secret information. It's something that everybody should know. If somebody desires, aitis theli, episomu akaluthain, if somebody desires to follow after me, ap arne sastho, let him deny himself, heauton, and arato, let him take up his cross, stauron, and akaluthaito, let him follow me. Now, let's pay attention to some of the tenses here. If somebody desires, truly desires, to follow akaluthain, notice, present infinitive. So I think that's more like being a follower of me, all right? Not just to follow me, like follow me into the house. As a matter of fact, when follow is simply used in that, oh, I don't know, what would you say, kind of more, you know, basic sense, then it's used in the aorist. I mean, take a look at chapter 14, verse 13, where Jesus is giving directions about following the guy into the house to prepare the Passover, and he says, you know, you're going to meet this guy with the jar, and then he says, akaluthesate, follow him. There it's aorist. Because you're just, this is a specified command. It's not going to be something ongoing. So just follow him. Here, we're talking about being a follower, not just like following up to Jerusalem. So the present is perfect here. Let him deny himself, he'auton. Notice, even though ap arne sastho is a middle, you have to add the reflexive, because the middle is not essentially reflexive. Let him deny himself, arato, let him take up his cross. Arato and ap arne sastho are both parsed the same. Aorist indicative active. I'm sorry, aorist imperative. Sorry, aorist imperative active, third person singular. Aorist imperative. That's why we translate it let. Let him deny himself and let him take up his cross and akaluthaito, let him follow me. Now there's that akalutheo again, and again it's in the present tense because he's talking about being a follower of him. 35. By the way, that was a third singular, present imperative active. 35. Hosgar e'an thele tain psychein autu sosai apolesai auton. Hos de'an apolesai tain psychein autu heneka mu kai tu oyangeleu sosai autain. Now, whoever desires, truly desires, notice it is a present subjunctive, thele. He desires his life will save it. Whoever desires his life to save his life, sosai, will lose it. Apolesai, that's from apolemi, third singular, future indicative active. And then, whoever, hosdan, whoever loses apolesai will lose his life on account of me and the gospel will save it. Now, a couple of grammatical points. Hos normally takes on, as you can see in the second clause. If you're following in the Nestle text, it's at the top line of page 117. that's the normal way to do it. But hos e'an, as you find in verse 35, hos e'an, well, sort of a Koine Greek way to do it, with e'an replacing on. It doesn't mean if here. It's just like on in a generalized clause. Whoever truly desires, thele, present subjunctive, to save his life will lose it, and whoever will lose his life on account of me and the gospel, will save it. Now, so there are some forms that instead of having apolesai, as the in the second half of the verse. It has apolesse, which is a subjunctive, which is what it should be. This was, well, I guess you would say this is kind of grammatically incorrect. To use a future indicative with hos on, should have a subjunctive there. Now, what is the meaning of psyche? This is really an interesting point. As a matter of fact, the range of meaning here is quite wide in Greek. It means everything from life to the spirit that departs your body at death, to the soul, Pindar uses it to mean the soul, to the immortal conscious self, something like that. Probably it's best in these verses to see this on a kind of a sliding scale. And that is to say, sometimes it means your earthly life. Sometimes it means your soul. Sometimes it seems to mean that, you know, the immortal you or something like that, that still survives. It's quite a, I don't know, what would you say? There's kind of a continuum of meaning here from earthly reality to beyond the earthly reality, life now to life after death. And it adjusts as you go through the passage. So if you have that you wish to save your life, will lose it, and whoever loses his life on account of me and the gospel will save it. Now see, will save it. What does that mean? That if you will lose your life, your physical life, on account of me, you will save your physical life? Probably not. So there's a range of meaning, and Jesus is playing with this. 36. Tigar ophelai anthropon kerdesai ton kosmon holon kai zemiothenai tain psychein autu. For what does it benefit that a man, what does it help that a man gain? What does it help a man to gain? Notice the infinitive kerdesai, to gain the whole world and to, now usually the translations will say something like forfeit his life. Well, tzemi a'o is an a'o contract verb, and it means to inflict loss on somebody, cause somebody to lose something. So, what does it help that a man gain the whole world and be made to lose something? Well, if I use this in the active, I have two accusatives. So I will inflict somebody with a loss, like say you, se, and then the thing I inflict a loss on, like psychein, will also be in the accusative. This is the double accusative construction. And when that verb gets turned into a passive, then one of the accusatives is retained, and it is the second one. So you could translate it like this. What does it help a man to gain the whole world and to be inflicted with loss, that he be inflicted with loss with respect to his soul or life? So the accusative is a retained accusative from a double accusative construction. My favorite construction. And you find these at various points throughout the New Testament. You know, verbs like to entrust somebody with something, to clothe somebody with something. Once you turn those into passives, that second accusative stays there. So this is to be inflicted with loss with respect to his soul. 37. For what doi, what shall a man give antalagma as an exchange for his soul, for his life. Well, doi, what is that form? Doi is a third singular subjunctive of ditto me. And what it's done, it's actually mimicked the uh-o contract verbs like dikaio, which go do, dikaio, dikaiois, dikaioi. It's mimicked that pattern. And as a result, if you take a look, if you're using the Nestle text, there's an interesting variation there at verse 37, which is do, which would be with a yoda subscript, and that's the second hand of aleph and el. And that would be the more grammatically correct form. That would be the more grammatically correct form, do. So, but why is it subjunctive? What shall a man give as exchange for his life? Well, here's why it's subjunctive. standing behind it is a deliberative subjunctive, something like this. What shall I give? Now, Jesus is doing this now in the third person. That is to say, what shall a guy give? It's a deliberative subjunctive standing behind there, a deliberative subjunctive. Check that out in Fundamental Greek Grammar, chapter 28. Deliberative subjunctive, but it's put in third person because it's only referring to one person here. Now, antalagma is something in exchange. When you have a ma ending, it's always something that you're dealing with. And then the genitive is what you're exchanging it for, in exchange for his life. Sort of like the genitive of price, price and value. 38. Hosgar e'an. There's our friend e'an again. Check him out the first time at the beginning of verse 35. For whoever, epaiskune me, whoever is ashamed of me and my words in the generation this one, te moichalidi, in this adulterous and hamartolo, sinful generation. Even the Son of Man, hohuias to anthropu, will be ashamed of him, auton. It's another one of these constructions like zemiao in verse 36. The thing you're ashamed of. So, aiskinomai, epaiskinomai, is to make somebody ashamed. Now, we're in the passive, and you're going to have an accusative of what you're ashamed of. He will be ashamed of him when, hotan, takes the genitive, elthe, when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels or with his holy angels. Elthe, third person singular, aorist, subjunctive, active, from erchemai, when he comes in the glory of his Father. You know, that passage reminds you of something like in Philippians 2, 10 and 11, where it says that every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. There is always this relationship where you might say the fountainhead of the Trinity is the Father. All right, let's go back and look at some theological stuff here. Now, there's so much in this passage. First of all, in verse 27, Caesarea Philippi. I said that it was Panias, dedicated to the god Pan, then rededicated to Augustus. Well, Augustus was worshipped as a god, and it was an imperial power base. This is probably one of the reasons why Jesus enjoined silence, because this could have gotten him arrested prematurely. So the Caesarea of Philip is actually a very prominent place. And so you have worship of Pan, and then you have, more importantly, worship of Augustus, who is claiming to be God. Now, 828, notice that it talks about, some of the people say that it's Elijah or one of the prophets. This is a big feature in Mark. That is to say that Mark pictures Jesus as a prophetic figure, and he always connects him to Elijah like this. I mean, the big connection with Elijah occurs in the next chapter, and that's after the Mount of Transfiguration, where there's the whole discussion in 11 to 13 of if Elijah has come and so on. Let's get on to you are the Christ at the end of verse 29. Of course, obviously a really key thing. Now, here's what's really interesting. Christos means anointed, so it's a kingly figure. Meshiach is masha, to smear with oil. Now, when you look in Mark at the use of this, it is really interesting how other concepts are linked to Christus. So, in 1532, it says, the Christ, the King of Israel. So you know it's the King of Israel, that this Christus brings up in people's minds. But also, in 1235, you have a connection to David. So Jesus says, Jesus in reply began to say, teaching them in the temple, how do the scribes say that the Ha Christus is the son of David? Aha! So the Christ, the anointed one, is now, here's another title, son of David. Then in 1461, at Jesus' trial before the Sanhedrin, they say, again, the high priest proceeded to ask him, and he says to him, are you the Christ, the son of the blessed, hawhuias tu oi logetu, the son of the blessed? Well, that's the son of God. So now the ha Christus is connected to son of God figures. So you have King of Israel, son of David, son of God. And what's going to happen in verse 39 is you're going to see this connected to Son of Man. Now, he's rebuked. He is not, warned in verse 30, Peter is, not to say anything concerning him. As I say, probably because they're in Panias, in Caesarea Philippi, being a Christus is a political being. King of Israel, son of David. And Peter was probably also thinking of him as a political Messiah. But he is right to say that he is Christus. But what he loads into that is probably not what Jesus is thinking. And we're going to see that now as we head into 31 to 38. So, in 31, he says, and he began to teach them, and here comes the first passion prediction, that it was necessary that the Son of Man suffer a lot and be rejected by the leaders and be killed and after 3 days to rise. Now, here we have betrayal, suffering, and death. And this is a big turn in the story. This, now, is a big turn in the story. Now, on what basis does Jesus make this turn? Well, the answer, I think, lies in the suffering servant of Isaiah. Now, this servant figure, the figure of the servant in Isaiah, has helped us to describe what's going on with Jesus right from the first chapter. In 1:11, he receives the Holy Spirit in connection with his baptism, even as does the servant of Isaiah 61:1, and also check out Isaiah 42:1, where it says in Isaiah 61, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me. And it also says in Isaiah 61, for proclaiming the good news. And so that is in Mark 1:14 as well. Calling out the acceptable year of the Lord, Isaiah 61:2, like in 1:15, the day is at hand, and comforting the people who mourn and so forth. Now, Jesus, using the description of the Son of Man, introduces, and this is the way I would put it, other figures, other features, that'd be a better way to say it, other features of the servant's mission, being handed over, being humiliated, being physically abused, killed, and finally regaining life. Now, by ascribing these features to himself, he embraces also these features in his role as the servant, suffering servant now, of Yahweh. So, if you look, there's a generalized correspondence between Jesus' passion prediction in 8:31 and Isaiah's detailed description of what's going to happen to the suffering servant. This is in Isaiah, the latter portion of 52 and in 53. So there's general correspondence and kind of specific correspondence, too, that signify that Jesus' fate corresponds to, all right, here's how I'm going to put it, the full broad portfolio of the servant of Isaiah's mission, including the role of the suffering servant. Because up to this point, the servant has been anointed, he's been receiving of the Spirit, he has proclaimed the good news, he has comforted those who mourn, but now also, and this is the big turn, he is going to embrace, I guess you would say, the suffering servant side of the servant. He's going to give his life as a ransom for many. So, one more thing about this, actually. I've argued previously on some of these lectionary at lunches that one of the big things in Mark is that it's subtle, but it's very real, is that the spiritual dimension, rather than the physical, is basic to our understanding of the proleptic coming of the reign and rule of God. And our relationship to God is key, and forgiveness of sins is central. That's why when Jesus heals a paralytic in 2:4, he says, "Be of good cheer, my son, your sins are forgiven." So now, the introduction of the suffering servant with this feature of his mission, of the servant's mission, and his destiny with death and resurrection, plus the introduction of this at this juncture in the gospel. And remember what I said at the beginning of this. At the beginning, I talked about this as the introduction of section 4. This is the critical section. Now you know not only that Jesus is the suffering servant, but it is confirmed that the relationship to God and the spiritual dimension is really the key dimension in our life and the key dimension in Jesus' ministry. And this is why he says in 10:45 that the Son of Man came not to be served but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Now, that's what it means in verse 33, to be thinking the things of God and not thinking the things of men. So, now we get 34 and following. If anyone desires to follow after me, let him deny himself, take up the cross, and follow me. So, here you see that what is critical is not the miraculous stuff, but the servanthood stuff, the suffering leading to triumph. Now, notice here that you get in verse 35 this interesting little phrase, which is not in Matthew, is that, you know, whoever loses or will lose his life, his psychein, on account of me and the gospel. Probably an indication of people, reading on level 3, people suffering for their confession of the faith. And that's Mark's context. And I think this, what he records here from Jesus, really reflects that. And what will someone give in exchange for his soul, his life? What is the thing you can give? And, of course, the answer is nothing. Now, whoever is ashamed of me and my words. Now, that's just like that emphasis on the gospel in verse 35. And my words. And notice it's emus. It's my words. That's an emphatic form, not moo. In this adulterous and sinful generation, also the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels, with his holy angels. Now, I referred to the great hymn to the humiliation of Christ in Philippians 2, 5 through 11, and that ends with, to the glory of God the Father, in exactly the same way. Now, what at 38 here, this is really hard, isn't it? The Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in glory if you do not confess him. Well, this is really similar to these great difficulties that you find throughout Mark of these kinds of things. You know, for example, in 4, 11 and 12, where it says that he has come to harden people, that in order that seeing they may see and not see, and in order that they may hear and not truly understand, lest they turn and it be forgiven to them. But if you keep your eyes open, judgment is never the last word. So the same as in chapter 4, 11 and 12, which we've just talked about, you have to go on to 33 and 34 at the end, where it says, such sort of parables, he was speaking to them the word, just as they were able to hear. And apart from a parable, he was not speaking openly to them. So there, as just as they were able to hear. So apparently it is God going the extra mile again to make sure his people get it. So the negative is always going to be trumped by the positive. I think that's what we have here, and we've got an interesting cross-reference to verse 38. And that's 2 Timothy 2, 11 to 13. It says, faithful is the word. If we have died with him, also we will live with him. If we endure, we will co-rule with him, sum basiloisimen. If we deny him, that one, he, will deny us. Well, so far, we're in 8:38. But now look at verse 13. If we are faithless, unbelieving, apistumen, that one remains faithful, for he is not able to deny himself. Yes, that's the gospel. He is not able to deny himself. This is Luther's great insight that the Christian life is the flight from God the judge to God the justifier. So that's always the last word, the word of his grace, which we can appeal to. Now, however, this doesn't mean that we should take any of this lightly, and that's the point of what happens here in Mark chapter 8. that it's going to be really uncomfortable on that last day when we are denied by him. It should turn out all right. 2 Timothy assures us of that. But no one should take this lightly. That's probably the best way to say it. And he will come. He will come in the glory of his Father with his holy angels. I mean, here we simply have to reckon with something like the Gospel of John when Jesus is on trial and he says, you know, don't you know that I could have 12 legions of angels? I'm not actually subject to all of this. And they could come and rescue me. So he has at his disposal everything. But what has he undertaken to do? 10:45. He has come not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Thank you very much.